The Guardian.
Hello, welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly, where today we'll discuss all the details of Project Restart with the Premier League coming back, and we will look back at the Champions League final of 1999 in the company of Lars Sivertsen and Kate Mason. Barry is here. Hey, Baz.
Hello, Max. How are you?
Really good. I have some breaking Jonathan Wilson news, Barry, for you.
Oh, my God.
He tweeted just before recording, "A squirrel just clattered out of a tree to land about 3 feet from me, then scuttled off. I looked up and in the tree was a crow looking smug. Do crows attack squirrels? Did it throw the squirrel at me?" We all know of Wilson's history with crows. It's good to see that they are keeping up their consistent attack on the stats man.
I like to think that the crow and the squirrel conspired against Wilson. It's like, I think it's what, Jaws the Revenge, the fourth one, which is really bad with Michael Caine in it, where the shark basically travels around the coast of America to follow Mrs. Brody and her family to exact revenge for the death of her baby shark in the previous movie. I like to think that maybe this crow has travelled all the way down to London from the northeast to continue its campaign of violence against Jonathan Wilson.
Well, Dave said, "I saw a guy on Saturday being dive-bombed by crows as he fixed a chimney. He resorted to fending them off by waving the TV aerial around his head like a samurai. Terrifying. Crows aren't to be trusted." And then he went on to say, "Also, why has the mainstream media never looked into why Kiora was too orangey for crows? Is the lamestream media hashtag in the pocket of Big Crow?" It's highly possible, Dave, and this is the right place to discuss it. Steph has been in touch every week, at least twice, Barry, asking for us to put together a Perm 11. I have, up to this stage, paid not a lot of attention. But after Thursday's pod about Newcastle United, he said, "Look, firstly, excellent podcast, very interesting debate. And therefore, whilst getting the Perm 11 is still very important to me, given the severity of the topic of conversation, I will on this occasion, with good grace, accept this was not the episode to discuss my topic." I mean, I suppose halfway through a discussion of Middle Eastern politics, we could have put Terry McDermott in the Perm 11. But can we promise to Steph that at some point we will do, I'm not going to say dedicate a whole pod to it, but we will do a Perm 11 for him?
Well, if Restart hadn't got off the ground, I suspect we could have devoted a whole pod to it, as we'd run out of anything else to talk about before too long. But yeah, why not?
Why not?
Kevin Keegan springs immediately to mind. Do I have a vague recollection? Did Dave Besant have a perm?
Was that just his hair? Was that just his... That was just... Well, I don't know what the difference is between just having that hair and actually actively perming it. Can you have a passive perm?
Phil Thompson had a very comical bubble perm when he played... basically, the Liverpool team of the 1980s.
They are Steph.
There's your 11.
And Bruce Grubbelaar. Right, well, look, thank God we've got that sorted and Steph could get on with the rest of his life and doesn't have to message me every minute of the day now. Although I welcome any interaction with fans. Let's crack on with the pod, shall we, Barry? After the break, we will introduce Kate and Lars and we'll talk about the Premier League returning. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's begin by talking about Project Restart, because the Premier League is coming back and we will do that in the company of Lars Sivertsen. Hello, Lars.
Hi, Max.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm feeling good.
Kate Mason, how are you?
I'm doing really well, thanks, Max. I'm pretty sad because I, unlike Lars, don't have a dog by my side to make this recording a lot more delightful. But other than that, really well, thanks.
I sort of feel Lars has been trying to make his dog a viral sensation of lockdown. I don't know how successful you've been, Lars.
I don't know. Some people like it when I put up photos of the dog. I haven't been trying very hard, Max. I haven't been putting up videos of her eating or just doing completely random things, which is, I guess, what you do if you're really desperate to make something happen on social media.
That's true. I wonder, Barry, if you feel that people with dogs just are a bit obsessed about telling everyone that they have a dog.
Well, like Kate, I'm very envious of anyone who has a dog. I would love to get one, but I don't have a garden in which a dog could frolic. My sister actually has a dog which is more or less identical to Lars's. It should be pointed out, Lars's dog isn't so much a dog as a wolf that looks like a small horse. It's like one of the, what do you call them in Game of Thrones? The dire wolves, isn't it? Very, very big.
Yeah, I get that down the park quite a lot, actually, yeah.
Are you feeding her on raw meat, Lars? Is that the kind of dog we're talking?
I am not. I mean, no, she's just on Lars on
has
kibble,
that himself,
kibble, really.
Doesn't he?
Yeah.
The raw meat is for Lars, and the dog
yeah,
gets
exactly
cooking.
Right.
Anyway, fascinating as this is, we should probably crack on. The Premier League is returning then on the 17th of June with Aston Villa, Sheffield United and Manchester City v Arsenal, a full fixture list the following weekend, and then a total of 92 games over 6 weeks. It's due to be finished by UEFA's deadline of the 2nd of August. The kickoffs will be Friday, 8 o'clock, Saturday, 12:30, 3 p.m, 5:30 p.m, 8 p.m, Sunday, midday, 2 p.m, 4:30 p.m, 5 p.m, Monday, 8 p.m, Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday. There'll be games at 6 and at 8. Every match will be shown live. 64 of them will be on Sky, 25 of those will be free to air, including the Merseyside Derby. BT will show 20 games, Amazon and the BBC will show 4 games each. That's obviously in the UK. How do we feel about football coming back and a lot of football in quite a short space of time, Barry?
Well, yeah, it's like you've crawled out of the desert and you're parched with thirst and sunburnt and exhausted. And someone standing there with a water cannon and just turns it on you full blast, isn't it? There's no such thing as easing back in. Loads of football on. I'm looking forward to it. I must say I'm still not entirely convinced by the wisdom of it, and I'm not convinced it will play out to a conclusion, but I'm happy to be proved wrong. And I think it may not be played out to a conclusion just because of the shambolic manner in which the government have closed, basically put an end to lockdown far earlier than they should. And I think that's going to result in a second wave of the coronavirus and a further lockdown, which may or may not be observed by people. But lots of football, ahoy. 4 games a day at the weekend. I'm not sure I'll have the appetite for all of them, but it's nice to have the options.
Kate?
Well, not only the Premier League, guys, because as of last night, we now know that the Championship will be returning on June the 20th. Always good to get that news at 9 p.m. as you're coming to the end of your Sky Sports News shift, of course. But what that means is that there are 108 of those games as well due to be played out live in almost exactly the same period. So, guys, you're missing football. No need.
Are Sky putting all of those games on live as well?
There's no details of it, but all the Championship have said is that they will all be put out somewhere, whether it is on Sky or on the kind of iFollow club accounts as well that you can that you can watch on there. Okay. So yeah, it's going to be impossible to watch all the football that is available to you. As it always is, I guess.
I suppose so. It's a bit like that sort of, it is the David Mitchell sketch, isn't it? All the football. And Lars, as someone who consumes an extraordinary amount of football, I mean, will this test your levels, or do you think you'll be able to manage all of it?
It won't. I mean, what it is extremely inconsiderate to this tiny, tiny minority of people who try to watch all the Premier League they can, but also want to watch other leagues. I mean, I really don't, because usually there are a couple of kickoff times where there isn't as anything much happening in England, and that is no longer the case. But we were doing the rewatch on before the weekend, and you're joking about how, like, will Baz be able to get through 8 games in one weekend without going mad? And I was thinking, that's a normal weekend, really. I mean, you can easily get through 4 games on the Saturday and the Sunday, and that's unless you watch MLS at night, like a lunatic. But that's not that dissimilar to me. But I do, on a personal note, I do dread trying to find space to keep watching the European leagues at the same time. But you know what? I think we can joke about how we'll now be watching football just really until September. I don't think we'll be doing much else, and that seems excessive. But I actually think it's really clever to stagger all the kickoff times, because it'll give more people a chance to see the games they want to see. And there's not that much else going on. Like, there's no point having them all at the same time and only televising one of them. That'd be really daft. So, yeah, it's fine.
And I guess, Lars, free to wear, we have been calling for, you know, football to be free to wear, at least some of it. I mean, that happened with the Cricket World Cup, didn't it? When England got to the final of the Cricket World Cup, they put that on Channel 4 and it made a big difference. It's obviously a balancing act for the broadcasters, who at the same time are in this debate with the Premier League about this rebate as well.
Yeah, so I've been thinking about this. I mean, there are very few times in life where you start going, won't somebody think of the broadcasters? Like, out of all the people in the equation, it's not really the party we tend to naturally feel sympathy towards. But I keep thinking, if you're Sky or MBT, like, you've paid so much money for this product. We've just been through a period of like 3 months where there has been no product being delivered at all. And now what is going to be delivered is, you know, by necessity, but it is still a very watered-down version of the product you paid for. And it's no longer, you're being forced to like put it on for free, some of it. It's no longer exclusive. So it's very far away from what they've paid for, what they'll be receiving. And I think it's nice of them to agree to it being free to air, quite a lot of it. But I do expect that they have a good case in terms of getting a rebate on what they've paid, really.
The government told the Premier League it had to show some of the games free to air and put more money into the Football League and grassroots game as a condition for restarting the season. There's a bit of admin on what happens if players test positive and full contact training, etc. So any player or member of staff who tests positive for COVID-19 will be expected to isolate for 7 days. Plans for what will happen if multiple players test positive are yet to be agreed. Full contact training is already underway, and from today, that's Monday, restrictions will be relaxed on, quote, unnecessary close contact, such as prolonged body-to-body work, including set-piece drills. Players have been warned they must stand 2 metres away from officials if they remonstrate with them on the pitch. Government guidance also states that dressing room usage should be minimised, although it said showers could be used if players kept 2 metres apart, although you wonder whose job it is to police that exactly. Teams will no longer be allowed to drive together on a coach, which I thought was interesting. Travel must be individually or by private transport where possible, but I don't know what that means for away games and air travel, which Premier League teams use routinely, or if this is just for training. And Jonathan Norcroft writing in the Times from Liverpool's training ground, saying, by the pitches, there are temporary gazebos and tents where physios and medics carry out their functions in full PPE. Makeshift gym stations have been placed pitch side and in the sports hall, with Melwood's main gym still closed. There are outdoor urinals, barriers to ensure distancing. It looks like a music festival, one club staffer observed. Interestingly, if it can't be finished, news coming out today, Premier League sides battling against relegation are expected to oppose the implementation of a points per game calculation if there is a second peak and if the games has to be suspended. I mean, it does seem, and if you look at the teams in Italy who want the season to resume and who don't, you look at League One, the teams that don't want points per game, it does seem sort of very coincidental that your morals completely align with where you happen to be in the league, regardless of what league it is at the time. Kate.
Yeah, but equally, I'm sure you saw that of the 1,130, I think it was, Premier League coronavirus tests that were run in the last week or so, not a single one of them came back positive. So I think, I'd imagine, if you were someone who was part of any of these clubs or institutions on whatever level, be a player or a physio or any part, playing any part in the running of the club, the fact that not a single positive COVID-19 test has been received over that period, I don't know. I think I would find that a comfort. And someone like Troy Deeney, who's been very vocal about it and, of course, has a little kid that he's concerned about having breathing difficulties, people know much more than me about how the conversations have gone with him specifically, but presumably from the manner in which he raised his concerns, he's not someone who would just think, oh, well, let's not worry about it then after all. I assume that someone has given him a quite clear picture of how this is going to work and why it is safe.
Well, it was the government's, I think, one of the medical advisors, Van Damme, not Jean-Claude, no relation, but he's been speaking at various daily briefings, and he's quite a straight talker. He was very quick to criticise Dominic Cummings the last time he appeared at a briefing. He didn't name Cummings by name, but it was quite clear who he was talking about, and it was him who spoke with Troy Deeney, and while he wasn't able to give him any assurances, I think he was able to reassure him enough to convince Deeney that going back to training would be okay.
Would be quite good if Jean-Claude Van Damme went around to the clubs and sort of explained to them how the lockdown should be done. Maybe just because we've had a problem with certain players not following the rules. Maybe if Jean-Claude Van Damme explained it to them, you know, Serge Aurier wouldn't keep going to the hairdresser or whatever
is that the action hero you choose? You're going through what were they called? The Expendables?
Yeah,
what was that film?
Van Damme is very good. Yeah, I think he could, you know, demonstrate some roundhouse kicks to sort of, you know, build a rapport with the players and see he's you know, he's one of them, and then explain, you know, don't go to the hairdresser just yet. That could be a thing.
Yeah, but on the flip side, Jadon Sancho got a haircut in Germany and he scored a hat trick. So maybe Serge Aurier is doing exactly the right thing. Maybe this is finally the superpower he needs.
Well, I shaved my head a couple of weeks ago and my life or career hasn't improved in any way. I do like the idea of training grounds being like music festivals, insofar as, you know, once training's finished, everyone sits around a campfire, someone gets a guitar out and they have a sing-song and a very long, meaningful, boring discussion about world peace.
Who's going to play No Woman, No Cry? That's the question.
And who's going to vomit in the tent?
Listen, I know people come to the Guardian Football Weekly for searing insight on serious issues, so I'm glad we've taken it in that direction. Can I just drag us back to perhaps more serious matters, the neutral venues dispute? There is a fear that fans might gather outside grounds. Anfield, the biggest concern, because Liverpool are going to win the title, their first title in 30 years. Slight mixed messaging coming from differing police departments. The Deputy Chief Constable, Mark Roberts, the head of UK's football policing unit, identified 6 games he said should be moved to neutral grounds, 4 of them involving Liverpool. That was at odds with the position of local police forces, Merseyside's force insisting it was ready to provide officers for home matches, and Greater Manchester Police saying it had yet to confirm a decision. The other games that have been requested to go to neutral venues, Man City, Newcastle, Manchester United, Sheffield United, not any match involving a London club, despite the fact Arsenal still have to play Spurs. That's with the London mayor, Sadiq Khan, expressing concerns about football's return at all. And Liverpool feel pretty strongly that their fans should not be singled out. The question is, I guess, will more Liverpool fans turn up to Anfield if the game where they win the title is at Anfield, or will they turn up at Anfield anyway, even if the game was played at the Amex or St George's Park or in the middle of the ocean?
Well, I have no idea, and only time will tell, but quite a lot of high-profile journalists, many of them who are either from Liverpool and or write a lot about Liverpool, have been very indignant at the notion that Liverpool fans can't be trusted to not turn up outside their own stadium or to travel to another stadium to celebrate when Liverpool eventually win the title. Now, I don't know if they can be trusted to do that or not, but some of these journalists, I'm going to use Ollie Holt as an example, who's not a Scouser, but he wrote about it in the Daily Mail yesterday. He and others, they're very indignant at football fans being singled out, and they're using crowds that are congregating on Clapham Common, say, various other parks and commons, various beaches, which we've all seen over the weekend, and saying, you know, well, why are football fans being singled out when the general public can't be trusted? And my problem with this is it's as if they're saying football fans only go to football matches and have no interest in any other activity. You know, a lot of those people on Clapham Common or on the beach, or, you know, in Southend or Brighton or wherever, I'm sure are regular match-going football fans. So the general public cannot be trusted to obey lockdown rules. They have proven this. And, you know, there are mitigating circumstances because they've been given very poor guidance. But the fact of the matter is, a lot of the general public can't be trusted to adhere to the rules of lockdown, and football fans are members of the general public. So I don't want to single out Liverpool fans. I'm sure if it was any other club who was about to win the title, I'm not sure their fans could be trusted. And I'm slightly puzzled and curious to know how these journalists are so confident that Liverpool fans won't turn up outside the stadium when Liverpool win the title, wherever they happen to win it. And we have precedent here, because when Arsenal won the title at Anfield in 1989, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of their fans turned up outside Highbury for a big party. And who could blame them? You know, they were obviously allowed to do that. But I can well imagine Liverpool fans doing the same, and I wouldn't particularly blame them either.
Yeah, as Barry, I think there is a certain lack of clarity around what people understand from the lockdown rules at the moment. And thinking back to when Champions League games were happening and PSG were playing against Borussia Dortmund, and there were hundreds and hundreds of Paris Saint, that was behind closed doors, there were hundreds and hundreds of Paris Saint-Germain fans letting off flares, you know, behaving as they perhaps normally would, perhaps with even more vigour and enthusiasm as fans than they normally would, those PSG fans. That was on the occasion, of course, huge for that club of getting to the next round of the Champions League. But as Barry says, Liverpool winning the title for the first time in 30 years after off the back of this massive hiatus and confusion and uncertainty. And when there's all this pressure of people having been stuck in their homes, having their routines disrupted, having everything thrown out of whack, who can blame them? The rules say that you're allowed to go outside and rest outside. I have huge empathy for fans who'd want to celebrate this extraordinary.
Sure. Like I said, the question is, some fans will congregate outside Anfield, right? Wherever the game is played. Will more fans turn up and therefore create a bigger risk with the pandemic if their players are inside that stadium, or will it make no difference at all? I don't expect any of you to have the answer, but that's the question, is it? Because if you decide, well, actually, it doesn't matter where they play, then you might as well let Liverpool play at Anfield for that game. And if you think it will make a difference, maybe you move it. I can't.
Well, Max, the thing is, the policeman you mentioned earlier, I think it's Mark Roberts from South Yorkshire Constabulary, has previous in the field of not making great decisions when it comes to football matches. And he also has previous in the field of making knee-jerk decisions. So I'm not entirely sure that he's thought this one through completely. And I'm not surprised that Merseyside police seem not to agree with him, and because they've made it clear they have no problem with Liverpool playing.
Mm. I mean, the question is as well, Lars, is the Bundesliga has kind of shown us that home advantage isn't necessarily as useful as it is when your own fans are in the stadium. A question from Daniel says, look, the Bundesliga ghost games seem to have killed home advantage. How do you think that will impact how the Premier League shakes out? Norwich, for example, have only won once away all season. Will their overall form improve enough with the loss of home advantage to avoid relegation? It's an interesting point, and it's kind of connected to why these teams would be so desperate to play in their own venues.
Yeah, I'm ever excited to sort of toot my own horn. I am tempted to go heavily on this sort of this no home advantage thing, because I did talk about this before, or certainly write about it, that this would be a thing. But honestly, having watched an awful lot of these Bundesliga games, it's still a pretty small sample size. And still, if you go through all these away wins, a lot of them are explainable in very rational footballing terms. But there's plenty of research that suggests that referees are swayed to some extent by crowds. And so there have been a couple of interesting ones. I do wonder, for example, in the big game between Bayern and Dortmund, there was a handball. Boateng basically saved a goal-bound shot, and it wasn't reviewed by VAR. I do wonder if you'd have had 80,000 sort of angry German industry workers in the stands sort of demanding something be done about this, if it would have been more likely to be looked at by VAR. And I mean, that would have probably been a penalty, and then the game goes differently. So I think the whole no crowds thing, it does definitely lessen the home advantage, even if I'd be slightly suspicious of drawing too many conclusions from three match days so far in Germany.
Although a very similar penalty was given to noble, plucky Paderborn, unfortunately having very limited impact on the overall game. So perhaps they've learned from their mistakes.
I have to say, I was watching that thinking, if I'm Dortmund, I mean, if that ended up mattering, I'd be quite cross, because that was a lot less of a penalty, really, than the one that wasn't even reviewed against Bayern. But yeah, I see what you mean.
There have been a couple of other interesting things to see from Germany. There's been a reported spike in strains and short-term muscle injuries following the resumption of football in Germany. pressing and counter-pressing intensity is down 14%. Wow, I sound like Lars. Someone else wrote this for me, Lars. You know, that could be the result of hot weather, or it could be lacking peak sharpness. There's been a significant spike in set-piece goals, as is often seen in international tournaments, perhaps because people aren't training as much together, or it's harder to train close together, or haven't been training for that long. So we could see those things come in to the Premier League.
I've also gotten the sense, I don't have the data to back this up at the moment, but the sense I get from watching these games is that the teams who rely on sort of herring about and smashing into people and winning challenges are not having a great time with the lockdown football, and it's more the sort of technically accomplished, sort of skillful, clinical teams who are enjoying it, which is slightly ominous for certain Premier League teams if we see that here in this country as well.
Yeah, it's harder to be subtle about crunching into someone if you can actually hear it in the silence.
Yeah, and I just think not having people in the stands, it probably takes away a little bit of edge. It maybe takes a little bit of adrenaline out of it. It probably takes away a couple of percentages, and if your game is all about winning 50-50s, then I think that's bad news for you.
Which Premier League player do you think is going to fare the worst now it's harder to clatter into someone two-footed because you've lost that 1% edge?
It sounds like you have an answer, Max.
Well, no, I mean, Lee Catamol is just running through my brain, but I know he's in League One. So is he in League One still?
He was last spotted in the Eredivisie, Max.
Oh, really? Oh, yes. Oh, that's absolutely right. So there, I don't have an answer. I don't know if anyone has an answer.
I think Jefferson Lerma is going to have a terrible time if you can't do that anymore. just an absolute card machine of a player. His number of yellow cards so far this season.
And how will this affect Burnley, Lars?
Yeah, so that's interesting. I would think in theory, lockdown football, no crowds, should not be good for Burnley. But that is the theory. But of course, Sean Dyche is a very smart guy, and you underestimate him at your peril. So I'd be very intrigued, put it that way. I'd be professionally intrigued to see how Burnley solve this situation. We've seen in Germany, like Augsburg and Union Berlin, who are sort of non-possession teams who like to not have the ball a lot and sort of run around and smash into people. They haven't been really having a great time so far. So interesting to see if that trend is replicated in England.
As Kate mentioned, the championship season is set to resume on the 20th of June. The EFL said the date was provisional, subject to the strict proviso that all safety requirements and government guidance is met. League One, right? The EFL are set to meet on the 8th of June, trying to work out how to finish things. Teams in League Two have already indicated they wish to end the season. League One sides remain undecided, Baz.
They do remain undecided, and it's difficult to see how they're going to reach any sort of conclusion that'll be even remotely satisfactory to everyone. I think this is because League One is, and I mean this not in a disparaging way, but it's a kind of a nowhere zone where it's full of teams that think they should be in the championship and teams that probably could well be, think they're lucky not to be in League Two. It's completely riven by self-interest. You know, so you've teams like Sunderland, Ipswich, big teams in League One who feel they've had kind of a divine right to be in the championship. And then you've, say, teams like Accrington who pull comparatively tiny crowds and wouldn't look out of place in League Two. And I mean this in no way to disparage Accrington. I think their own chairman's been very vocal on Twitter. But I'm mystified as to how League One is going to sort itself out, because so many teams are riven by self-interest, and it's hard to see how they're ever going to agree on anything. A lot of teams in League One don't even want to play out the season. They just want to end it because it would be too expensive for a lot of them to stage games without crowds.
In the women's game, it was cancelled last week. I draw your attention to Susie Rack's piece last week about comparing Germany and the US getting some football back compared to the FA here. As she says, in Germany and the US, governing bodies are showing that if you're bold, women's football does not have to be a casualty of this crisis. Instead, it can be a pioneer. The Shadow Minister for Sport, Alison McGovern, today says, "To bin women's football this season without a broader plan to protect the gains we've made recently is a huge mistake. We need to hear urgently from the FA and from Premier League clubs what their intentions are. Will women continue to pay the price for a ban 99 years ago that still overshadows women in football today? Or is there a road to equality? Women players and supporters deserve answers."
Yeah, it's a fascinating piece, that one. I know I'm not alone in feeling pretty sad about how this has played out for the women's game. On Sky, we had Hope Powell, the Brighton manager, on over the weekend, and she said she completely supported this decision to close the season. because of the financial implications of these tiny, in many cases, tiny little clubs with not much resource having to support testing. And if obviously, you know, these managers are used to working within the strictures and within extremely limited financial resources. That's what the women's game has had for tens of years. But the fact is, as Germany has shown, that doesn't need to be the case. Some sort of financial support could have been put in place. Spoke to Maggie Murphy, who runs Lewis. That's a club in the Championship women's team. You know, she's always talking about how the FA Cup prize money should be allocated better to perhaps support women's clubs. And that could have been one place where resources could have been gathered. So basically, it's just very sad that where there's been such a lot of financial disparity anyway for between men and women playing football, ultimately it seems to be coming down to the cost of testing, and that it's just so much easier to bin off, as that MP said, the women's game than to really take a moment to take a stand. And my concern is that throughout women's sport at this point, it's being left behind, because the men's game is, across all sports, apart from arguably tennis, it's just so much more powerful and has so much more financial resource to withstand even a shock like this.
Serie A have announced the date for their return. It will be June the 20th. We'll get Nikki on soon to talk about that. The first game back in La Liga will be June the 11th. Real Betis Sevilla. Barcelona will take on Real Mallorca. They'll go to Mallorca on the 13th of June, and Real Madrid host Eibar the following day. As La Liga resumes. Time now for Lars Siverton's Bundesliga Rundfunk. It's been a while, Lars.
Auf geht's. Jawohl.
Yeah, and we should start with Jadon Sancho's first career hat-trick. Great performance from him.
Yeah, terrific performance. Borussia Dortmund, they took their time, but they eventually completely picked Paderborn apart. I think they had a point to prove after their disappointment against Bayern. Jadon Sancho didn't look fully fit against Bayern. He certainly looked fully fit here. Absolutely terrific hat-trick. And of course, he removed his shirt to display a message of support for George Floyd, which was a nice moment, I thought. Of course, the rules being what they are, he got booked for it, which seems unfortunate, but here we are. There was also...
It's interesting you bring that up. Rob Harris has written in AP a piece saying football's out of touch for suppression of on-field activism. Any messages on undergarments from the political and religious to the personal have been prohibited since 2014, although the penalty is left to each league to decide.
So I mean, I think it's slightly... I'm sure Rob isn't confused. He's a very good journalist and a smart guy. But, I mean, he would have been booked for taking his shirt off, regardless of whether there was a message there or not. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the taking the shirt off that you get booked for. But there is also additional rules in the laws of the game prohibiting political statements. It's one of those where I can see the logic of that rule, but there are times where you wonder if the referee could just, you know, not book him, I guess, which is probably why I'd be a terrible referee, but I just would apply the laws as I felt. But I mean, those are the laws of the game as we stand.
That the rule was introduced to avoid inciting the crowd, which is rendered rather moot by the fact that there isn't anyone at the game.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess it's easy to say it's a dumb rule when it's a statement that we all agree with. It's easy enough. But if all the sort of Brazilian lads who like Bolsonaro started like doing pro-Bolsonaro messages on their shirts after scoring a goal, we might feel differently about it. So I don't know. I think that's a slightly thornier subject than it might seem like on the surface.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. Ashraf Hakimi had his own yellow Justice for George Floyd t-shirt when he scored. He wasn't booked.
I think the ref might have just missed that, or maybe he had a change of heart
possible.
Or something. Yeah.
And just to finish the protests, American midfielder Weston McKennie of Schalke wore an armband with the handwritten message Justice for George around his left arm. Marcus Thuram took a knee after scoring for Borussia Mönchengladbach. On a different note, Richard Jolly, his tweet of the pod, Marcus Thuram has now scored as many league goals this season, 10, as Lilian Thuram scored in his 18-season career.
Anyway, we're mentioning Richard Jolly, I mean, he also said today we've been in lockdown for 70 days, which is as many days as Dave Hockaday was in charge of Leeds. And I think that should be the new scale for the length of pandemics. Like, we have the Richter scale from earthquakes, could have the Hockaday scale for pandemics. We're currently at one hock. moving forward. Anyway, yeah, Borussia Dortmund won. Bayern Munich won 5-0. So, I mean, there's full steam ahead for Bayern, who look untouchable at the moment. It is something quite terrifying of having Bayern at the moment, who have the best individuals in the league, but they're also doing the basics better than anyone else in terms of pressing and everything. They're quite relentless and extraordinary. I think one of the big stories this weekend, Werder Bremen won at Schalke. Schalke incredibly bad at the moment. They're winless in 11, which is their worst run since the mid-90s. David Wagner really having a bad time there after starting the season very well. They're plummeting down the table. Whereas Werder Bremen, who had looked quite doomed, have now two wins and a draw in the last three. So they're certainly within touching distance of maybe staging some sort of great escape at the bottom there. It's easy to forget Werder Bremen, you know, historically a great team in the Bundesliga. I just checked out the sort of all-time Bundesliga marathon table since its inception in the 60s, and Werder Bremen are second. You know, they're a team who have been sort of not winning a bunch of trophies, but they've been consistently near the top of the table. They've been looking pretty bad this season. Looked like they were going to get relegated, but some sort of rescue could be on the horizon there. There were other games, but in terms of what's worth mentioning, Schalke are so poor. It's distressing to see them like this. And David Wagner, who seems like a nice guy, did a great job with Huddersfield. The team showed real promise in the autumn. They've really regressed to something truly horrendous now, and I think his days are probably numbered there.
Thank you, Lars. I very much enjoyed your Rundfunk.
Danke.
And that'll do for part two. Part three, the four of us will look back at Manchester United's Champions League win of 1999. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's look back at the 99 Champions League final. Manchester United 2, Bayern Munich 1. Those two goals in injury time cancelling out Mario Basler's 6-minute free kick. First of all, then, where were you? Where and when? Kate, do you remember watching the game? How old were you?
Oh, God, I don't really remember it, Max, although I feel now as though I do remember it, which is the great bizarre thing of memory, isn't it? I've got some whole load of fictional memories that I've just implanted in my mind to prove that I'm an authentic football supporter like Jacob Steinberg last week, going on about how he knew everything about football when he was 9. So yeah, I think I was about 9 or 10. I can't do the maths. And who knows if I remember it? I feel as though I do. I would have been at home, I imagine.
Barry, I mean, normally you don't remember it.
Well,
either.
I have very specific memories of this. I was in the flat on the quays of Dublin, opposite the Clarence Hotel, of my friend and colleague Stuart Clark, who's the deputy editor of Hot Press magazine now. And there was an array of us who worked in sort of music media circles in his flat, and we all wanted Manchester United to lose. I'm not sure why. I think it's just because everyone hated Manchester United at the time. And towards the end of the game, someone lost their cigarette lighter down the back of the sofa, and we were all rummaging around trying to get this Zippo lighter out from the back of the couch. And George Byrne, who many Irish listeners will remember as a sort of controversial, contrarian music critic who sadly passed away a few years ago at a horribly young age, George got very, very upset because we weren't focused on the TV sending negative anti-Manchester United vibes to Barcelona, but were instead distracted by the search for this lighter down the back of the sofa. And he got really, really angry with us. I mean, we'd all had a drink, it must be said. He got really angry with us for not concentrating on the game, but concentrating instead in finding this bloody Zippo lighter down the back of the sofa. And we were laughing at him for getting so angry about it. But it turned out George was absolutely spot on. And for that reason, Manchester United and their supporters owe me and a couple of my mates a huge debt of gratitude. Because if we hadn't dropped a lighter down the back of a couch and started foostering around looking for it, Manchester United would not have won that game.
Did you find the lighter?
We did, yes.
Okay, that's good to know. I was at university watching it in the junior common room. I am still a man of the people, it's important to say. And two of my northern mates, you're only allowed three at the university I was at, Mark and Mark, had bet £100 on Manchester United to win. And it was just such a sort of absolutely awe-inspiring amount of money. Just no one could believe that they'd bet that much money on a football match. And so when that, like, the sort of joy, their sort of unbridled, extraordinary joy, I think they probably only doubled their money, but it was, that's my absolute, like, cast iron memory of this game, was the absolute shock on their faces. They went from losing £100, like their eyes were sort of broken, and then it turned around and their joy was unsurpassed.
Joy only matched probably by Ole Gunnar Solskjaer as he realised that he'd scored the winner. That expression on his face, the face that looks basically the same today, kind of extraordinarily. Yeah, as you'll remember, Max, I did push for a number of other games apart from this one. I had heard Clive Tilsley say, who was commentating on the game, that it was one of the worst games of football he's commentated on in his career for 80 minutes. Really one of those games that perhaps highlights are just a better bet. And I was pushing for all sorts of things, including the 2002 game between Italy and South Korea, apparently too niche for the internet to have stolen. And indeed, of course, Spurs winning their last major trophy. But actually, I just watched the last bit of it again. And yeah, I think you could take or leave much of the middle bit, but what's an extraordinary game to watch.
I mean, it's amazing that 2 minutes of football and how it defines so much. Peter Schmeichel's last game for United, you know, he's in that melee. You know, the last shot of him is basically in the opposition penalty area. Giggs mishits that shot. What if he catches it cleanly and it's saved? Sheringham, you know, just manages to sneak it in the corner. 2 minutes later, another corner. Sheringham's near post run. Solskjaer sticks out a leg. I mean, that moment for Solskjaer, Lars, and I mean, I wonder what that moment was like for Norway.
It was huge because, of course, we were a nation of Man United fans at the time and maybe still are, and partly because of their relentless success in the 90s and also part of the reason because there were quite a few Norwegians involved. I think with Solskjaer, the thing to remember is, I mean, you get this sometimes with foreign players or even if they're not from there, that when they arrive at a club and when they spend some time at a club, it just clicks into place and they just find a home there, really, and they never want to leave. I mean, Solskjaer is someone who was a true believer to the United cause and still very much is. And I think maybe that was one of the things that always made him very likable. He comes across very well. He scores goals. He doesn't mind if you put him on the bench forever and ever. And he's a very likable fella. But no, he was really... I mean, years later in Norway, he would sort of offhandedly refer to Manchester as home, you know, going home to Manchester. He really sort of, he loved it there. And if he has a face, his face there is very much what you would imagine a fan's face would look like if he scored a match-winning goal in a Champions League final, and that's because he was.
A question from Jake. Do you think that if Ole doesn't score that goal, he would still be the Manchester United manager? I think we've had this conversation before.
I think maybe it might be possible that he isn't. Maybe he'll be a little bit less of a legend there and it wouldn't have worked out in quite the same way. I think that is an interesting hypothesis, put it that way.
Yeah, I don't think he would. I you know, because it's such a seminal moment. You know, if Sheringham catches that ball more cleanly and it goes in, I wonder if it, you know, how that changes the life of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. Jake says, like, how many careers were changed because of that win? And that's an interesting question, isn't it?
Yeah, I think Jake's absolutely right. And I think this is a thought that you share as well, isn't it, Max, about on these fine margins and moments, how many lives turn. It's one of the great truisms of sport, basically, isn't it? It's why the narrative is so incredible to follow. But actually watching this game and seeing Solskjaer coming on as a sub and remembering... Again, I don't know if these are imagined memories, but thinking I remember how as a substitute, he's a player who understood the game and would come on and add something to it. He has and had an analytical brain that he was using back then as a player. So it makes sense that he would go on to be a good manager. The question of whether he should have been managing Manchester United as of 2 years ago, you know, perhaps that might have been a later stage career thing that he could have aspired to off the back of his time in Cardiff. But the fact of his mind, of his managerial mind, I think was in evidence in the way that he would come on as a substitute and make those game-changing efforts.
Well, you asked about how many different players this their careers, this game changed, you know, but and I think on the Bayern team, while it didn't change his career because he was approaching the end of it anyway at the time, I think it affected Lothar Matthäus's reputation because he came in for a lot of criticism afterwards from his own teammates, I think for instigating his own substitution late on, and him going off caused Bayern a lot of problems, and it could be argued cost them the game because they had to do a reshuffle. And I think some of his teammates came right out and accused him of cowardice for not finishing the game. So it did kind of affect his reputation. I mean, he had a pretty bad reputation anyway, but as a man, you know, no, I don't think anyone doubts his abilities or as a footballer, but as a bloke, he's not hugely popular, even in Germany, and this didn't help.
But he's nearly 39, isn't he?
I know,
this point. And he's coming off thinking that he's won pretty much every silverware you can win as a footballer. World Cup, Bundesliga, everything. And finally, the Champions League. And then he realises he hasn't. I don't know. I have sympathy for the man.
Yeah, I've read an interview with him from 442 magazine, or an interview, it might be a column, something. He wrote anyway that actually for this game he had taken on a slightly different role because he was usually a sweeper, and he's often listed like as a sweeper in this game, but according to him, he had been asked by Hitzfeld to go step up in midfield more and put pressure on David Beckham and sort of basically keep him from running the game. So he ended up running around a bit more in this game than he otherwise would have. So his version of it, Matthäus, is that he said to the coach after 75 minutes, I told the coach I was feeling tired, I'd be making different runs in midfield than when I played sweeper where I didn't have to run as much. I didn't tell the coach that he had to take me off, only that I was tired, and if he did want to substitute me, I would agree.
He didn't just take him off as well. You know, Basler comes off just before the end. It looks like Hitzberg is just like closing out the game. We're done here, even though they were only 1-0 up, which seems mad.
Sure, but they were putting on like sort of fresh legs and that sort of thing. I mean, you'll find coaches who'll tell you that in a situation like that, having some fresh legs who can run around a bit is not a bad thing to have, though I completely see what you mean.
Can you be guilty of overanalyzing something where there's a lot of good fortune involved? And we were talking about fine margins because I'd watched the that Michael Thomas goal recently against Liverpool, and obviously, you know, Lee Dixon finds Alan Smith, who controls it brilliantly and plays the pass into Thomas's path, but Steve Nicol comes flying in and takes the ball, and it just cannons back off Thomas right into his path. And really, 99 times out of 100, that Steve Nicol clearance, wherever it goes, it might bounce back off Thomas, but it just doesn't end there. And that changes the whole narrative of that entire Arsenal team as well. And it changes all their lives.
Yeah, I completely agree, Max. And if Sheringham scuffs his shot and the equaliser doesn't happen, you know, the game probably ends 1-0 and people will say, ah, yeah, the Hitzfeld, he was very clever. You know, he got on the fresh legs and it was sort of, it would have been fine. And we'd be writing tactical blogs about what a good operator he was. So, I mean, I think there's an element of that.
Would people say that to Hitzfeld in a comedy German accent? It would be slightly insulting, especially at such a traumatic time.
I've heard some very strange things said to Hitzfeld. I was at an international friendly between Switzerland and Argentina, and in the post-match interview, Hitzfeld was in charge of Switzerland. One of the first questions in the post-match interviews was from an Egyptian fella who got up in the press conference and just wanted to say to Otmar Hitzfeld, on behalf of all of Egypt, thank you for your great work as a manager and your wonderful career, and then just kind of sat down again in the presser after an international friendly. Hitzfeld looked very confused. Now there was no just comedy German accent on show, but it was a good moment.
I draw Barry to the time him and I were interviewing the chairman of the Faroe Islands FA, and his first question was, are you wearing a Viking hat before you start disparaging Lars for putting on a comedy German accent. Can I ask about Sir Alex Ferguson? Obviously, this doesn't define his career because he had quite a good one aside from this. But it is his first European Cup. You know, Manchester United's second European Cup and his first one. And I wonder how. And the treble, of course, is such a monumental achievement. I wonder how pivotal those 2 minutes are for Sir Alex's legacy.
Well, they're huge. I mean, he's kind of a cranky Scottish Captain Ahab, and the European Cup was this white whale, and he caught it here. You know, he admits himself in his autobiography that he, as the game entered its closing stages, he had sort of lost interest in the game and was kind of trying to figure out in his head what he was going to say afterwards. And of course, he has also since said, because let's not forget, this was also a pivotal occasion, a monumental occasion in English football writing, because the stories are legend of, you know, all these journalists who were at the game, who had their articles written, had their intros written, and all had to be binned off. And for anyone listening who isn't quite aware of how these things work, this is a game on midweek game, late kickoff. So you're operating to a very, very, very tight deadline. You have to submit half your report at half time. You have to submit the next 25%, say, on 75 minutes. And then you just send in an intro and a tail, top and tail, they call it, a couple of minutes before the final whistle or on the final whistle. So everyone had their 1,000, 1,200 word reports written, and they all had to be consigned to the dustbin, and you to write an entire new report. The stress involved is absolutely horrendous. It's happened to me a couple of times. I don't do match reports very often, but it is you feel physically ill. I mean, it is so stressful. So a lot of the match reports that would have appeared in first editions would have been absolute gobbledygook, because they'd have the intro would have been this magnificent Manchester United defeat, followed by 800 words of how awful Manchester United had been.
Yeah, but that's not entirely wrong, is it? Because it's quite a strong argument that Ferguson did get his team selection wrong. I mean, I'd need to look back at it, but I think there were only, or possibly no chances for Manchester United in the first 60, at least 60 minutes. And really, it was when he made those two substitutions. Okay, what a genius. He knew how it was all going to work out. But that was the moment when the game came alive. So it's not strictly incorrect to say what those original match reports would have said, which is that it wasn't a great game. It wasn't a great game.
But he was slightly hamstrung. He didn't have Keane. He didn't have Scholes. And by their own admission, Giggs didn't play well. Jesper Vlahovic didn't play well. Andy Cole has said he had a mare on what was the biggest game of his career. And who else? Dwight York didn't play well. So Ferguson couldn't have foreseen that.
And let's face it, Schmeichel let in a goal he probably wouldn't have done on another occasion. So that too.
I mean, Bayern Munich are so unlucky in this game, right? I mean, they soaked up the pressure of what pressure there was. They scored early. Mehmet Scholl hits the post with this glorious chip. Carsten Janker, as you mentioned, Lars, hits the bar with this overhead kick. And you know, I had to check that they were both in the Bayern squad, the side that won the Champions League in 2001. I'm so relieved for them, both of them, that they had a chance for absolution.
I'm relieved for them, and I'm relieved for Samuel Kufur as well. I mean, it's one of the sort of iconic images of the night in Barcelona, is him sort of punching the ground in frustration. I believe it was him who gave away the corner and him who was meant to be marking Solskjaer for the goal. So it's not great for Samuel Kufur. And he's a guy who had like an incredible story. He was the only non-German player in the starting lineup for Bayern. I mean, he grew up in a pretty rough area outside Kumasi in Ghana. He said himself that he would sort of shine people's shoes on his way to school to make some money. You know, it's not an easy upbringing, single parent household. When he was called up to the Ghanaian under-17s, this is he himself said this, that he didn't have football boots, so his mum had to sell the family TV, and he had three sisters, so his mum had to tell them the TV was for repairs, because she didn't want to tell them they'd sold the TV so that Samuel could get football boots for the under-17s. And so he's come a pretty long way and had a pretty extraordinary journey since then, and losing a Champions League trophy in that manner is not great. So it was good for him that he got it 2 years later.
Almost the absolute devastation of the Bayern players is even more poignant than the celebrations of the United players. You know, and it's so rare that before a game is over that players are just horizontal and broken on the floor.
Well, the ref actually had to go around after United's second goal and implore the Bayern Munich players to get to their feet and kick off, restart the game, because they didn't want to. They knew, you know, that's it, we've lost. For that to happen, the ref to actually sort of physically drag them to their feet, come on guys, you got to kick off here, it sort of tells you all you need to know.
I'm not sure how much sympathy I had for that, to be honest. I feel like you're...
How can you not?
So, in the Ajax-Tottenham game in the Champions League, similar sort of format, the Ajax players, young, idealistic, whatever, coming up in their careers as footballers, you can see how they made mistakes and were lying around on the ground. Perhaps you had more sympathy for them. But looking at these guys, these are hardened professionals, many of them. We talked about Matthäus, you know, nearly 39. He's a grown-up man doing a professional job. Get up and kick off. Nah.
I don't think that's how it works. But, you know, the emotions of it, I think in many ways it's kind of reassuring that they might be sort of hardened professionals and they might be, you know, paid incredibly well and et cetera, et cetera. But actually, they care so massively about this extraordinary thing.
But you could make an argument that it's disrespectful not to get up, just get up and go and kick off as you're supposed to in this game of football.
Do you have a heart, Kate?
No, actually, I actually don't.
It's black and made of granite.
It's my great secret.
It's in there.
James says, can you discuss the fact that Thomas Linker played the final with a massive hoop earring? Was this normal at the time? He says, I have no photographic evidence for this.
He was wearing a big earring. I did see that on our video. Whether that was normal at the time, you'll know better than me, Max.
Is that the first ever referee to not go... Jewelry, studs, check the studs for no reason. No one's ever said, can you take that stud out? And he just forgot to do the list down the Bayern players. Steph says, my favourite United memory ever. However, it will always be tarnished by David May jumping up over the top when they lifted the trophy. In years to come, my kids will see this and say, who's that man in the middle? That's David May. Was he really good then? No. I mean, he wasn't bad, David May, was he? But it's quite an extraordinary moment. And it's sort of fleeting. It's only for a few seconds. But he is right there. And in so many photos, he's above the European Cup. It's like he's part of the trophy.
Well, David May was quite unlucky not to start this game. Because Roy Keane and Paul Scholes were absent, I think Alex Ferguson was going to start Nicky Butt in... midfield, and he wasn't sure who to put alongside him. And I think there was talk that Ronnie Johnson might get the gig, which would have meant David May, who had played in the FA Cup final a few days previously, would start in the centre of defence. But because Nicky Butt was so sort of essential to the European Cup plan, he wasn't picked for the FA Cup final in case anything happened. Roy Keane ended up being injured quite early in the cup final, which meant David Beckham went into midfield and he played so well that he started this game. And that annoyed Ryan Giggs. And I'm taking this from an article I read Rob Smythe wrote. This isn't all my knowledge and memory. So Ryan Giggs was apparently quite annoyed by all this because he wanted to play in midfield, but he ended up playing on the left wing and Blomqvist was on the right. And apologies to any Manchester United nerds if I've got any of those little details wrong, but that's basically the gist of what I'm trying to say is David May was quite unlucky not to start this final.
Yeah, it was also because Henning Berg was injured as well, which was a big problem for them, of course. You know, one Norwegian down is not what you want. But we've talked a lot about sort of the sliding doors moments and the fine margins of this. I would deposit another thing, which is that I have things to say about the first goal. I mean, obviously, it's a free kick that Peter Schmeichel should save, to the point that Clive Tilsley thought it had taken a deflection because it just didn't make any sense that it would go straight in that manner and that Schmeichel would lose it. I also don't think it's a free kick. Like, watching that one back, I mean, we've mentioned Carsten Janker already, usually such a like a big... sweaty slab of pink Teutonic man meat, you know, usually very hard. Here he was sort of flopping about in a very undignified manner. It's not what you want to see. And poor Ronnie Johnson was completely caught unawares there. And no, that was not a free kick for me.
Producer Ian's very exercised by Ronnie Johnson's frosted tips.
Yes. That was extraordinary Frosted Tips, almost like sarcastically 90s Frosted Tips.
I suppose Ronny Jonsson's Norwegian heroism is he's sort of one behind Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, I presume, in that. But it must have been sort of, he was just sort of there as sort of like the backing band for Solskjaer, was he?
I might be being very unfair to him here, but my overwhelming sort of memory of Ronny Jonsson is one of frustration, one someone who could have been a truly brilliant centre-half if he didn't keep getting injured. Poor guy, he had so many muscle injuries throughout his career, or I think they were muscle injuries. He had a bunch of injuries, but he was present and correct. And apart from being bamboozled by a Janker for the free kick there, I thought he was good.
It's worth mentioning that Man United and Bayern Munich had been drawn together in the group stages and drawn both those games. Bayern finished that group top. United came second. They both got through above Barcelona. And one of United's most famous victories is that semi-final second leg away in Turin against Juventus, coming back from two goals down to win 3-2 with Andy Cole's late goal. Did anybody know that prior to kickoff in this game at the Nou Camp, the opera singer Montserrat Caballé was moved around the field on a golf cart performing a live version of Barcelona, the song she recorded with Freddie Mercury in 1987, accompanied by a recording of Mercury on the stadium's electronic screen?
I'm a huge fan of that.
Glorious moment.
More sort of more opera singers on golf carts ahead of big games, I think.
I think
less
so.
Sort of David Guetta and whatever it is they're getting nowadays. Get the opera singers in on the golf cart.
I was excited that they all arrived by Concorde, but maybe that was just de rigueur at that time for football teams.
It's not a very long flight. I'm not sure it's necessary.
Yeah.
How much time are you really saving?
I think we've pretty much covered it. If we're talking about golf carts and Concorde, probably suggests we have covered everything we need to in this game. And that'll do for today's Guardian Football Weekly. Thanks so much for your time, Kate.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Lars.
Anytime, Max.
Thanks, Barry.
You're very welcome.
We'll be back on Thursday with the life and times of Barney Ronne.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.